Trevor Jackson on 936 ABC Hobart.
Imagine if you had the chance to speak to your favourite songwriter. You could ask them anything you wanted about the songs that had changed your life, or at the very least, given it a little more meaning and perspective. For instance, imagine being able to ask John Lennon about, well, imagine, what inspired him to write it, and how he felt about the significance it's given so many people around the world. It would be an extraordinary insight, I'm sure. Unfortunately, it's a little too late to talk to Mr. Lennon, but one intrepid music journalist has taken the opportunity to talk to many of Australia's most significant songwriters of the modern era about the process of how they write, the circumstances under which some of their best songs were written, and the context within which they were written. Debbie Kruger has called her book Songwriters Speak, Conversations About Writing Music. And this afternoon she's agreed to share some of her revelations for Desert Island Discs. Debbie, a brilliant idea, pardon the pun, but how did you hit on the idea to do this?
Thanks, Trevor. Well, I've always been a voracious reader of books on music. And although there have been books written about the Australian music scene from a historical perspective, they've mainly been focused on the sort of the glam side of it, the performance side of it, band politics side of it. But nobody had ever spoken to the people who really are the true backbone of the music business, which is the songwriters. But there have been books written overseas of this kind, Q&A style interviews with songwriters, great American songwriters particularly. I just wanted to do an Australian version of it. No one had. Someone had to, and I wanted it to be me.
I always thought that either songwriters were too reluctant to discuss the process, or just found it the mystique of writing, even after, in some cases, many years of doing it and having incredible success with their music and writing some fabulous pieces, that they just didn't understand it, so they were reluctant to talk about it. What did you find when you spoke to them?
Well, I didn't. I mean, I agree that a lot of them don't understand where the mystery, where the mysterious process of how a song comes to them. They can certainly talk about the mechanics of putting a song together. They can talk about the spark of inspiration, what the story is behind a song, and we can talk about the influences that they had musically and family and religion and all that sort of thing. But yes, I mean, most of them feel that it is a mysterious thing and they can't put their finger on where it comes from, but that's kind of the joy of the process for them. And so I certainly wasn't going to sit there and quiz them, well, where does it come from? You know, you have to answer this question. Where? What is the answer? How does a song become a song? It was all those other things that go into writing a song, you know, a person's background, their beliefs, their loves, their life experiences, where they come from. So we talk about that in addition to, okay, I pick up a guitar and I find a chord that I like and that makes me think of a word. Everyone's different take on that mechanical process, and that's what makes a great conversation. You can't ask somebody to solve a mystery that is eternal.
That's fair enough. But it's I like the fact that you've looked at it from a much bigger picture, cultural influences, the dynamics within the band or within songwriting partnerships, and, of course, the events surrounding their lives at that time when the song was written. So it's a very interesting perspective and in-depth. Now, if we start with Harry Vander and George Young, and as you quite rightly say, they are, in fact, the most successful songwriting, production, artist development collaborators in Australian music history. I mean,
yes.
Aside from their own successes, artists like John Paul Young, William Shakespeare, The Angels, Rose Tattoo, Ted Mulry, AC/DC, Cheetah, on and on it goes. Plus, of course, their own work with the Easy Beats and Flash in the Pan.
Extraordinary
talent.
Well, it's such an amazing thing to get George to do an interview, because nobody else has been able to get George Young to talk since, you know, in the last 15, 20 years. So to get him at all was just great. So I was quite content with whatever he wanted to say, to be honest. But, you know, I think he gave some very specific answers to questions. And that's not just indicative of the fact that he might be a slightly reluctant interviewee. It actually is indicative of the fact that he is a no-nonsense sort of guy. And to an extent, Harry is like that too. They never had any pretensions that they were artists we look at their work and we analyse it and we go, wow, you know. But something like Evie, parts 1, 2, and 3, which I think is just one of the greatest songs ever written and recorded in this country, such an epic, sweeping journey of a song, musically, thematically, emotionally, and yet they just shrug their shoulders and go, well, yeah, you know, we just had some ideas and it was about this bloke who loved Evie, so, you know. We could have written about 5 different songs, but we pieced them all together and, oh, nothing fancy about it being an 11-minute song. It was just good for the DJs to go and have a smoko. And that's just how they are. It was very no-nonsense. They didn't set out to be artists. They set out to be pop songwriters.
Yeah,
and they wanted to make money from it. They wanted to have hits and make money.
I got the impression, yes, that they were very much, if not artists, but at least craftsmen in the working sense of tooling away at their trade.
They're just great pop craftsmen and great impresarios in a way. So that's the way, that's their story, that's the way they wanted to talk about it.
You described Friday on My Mind as the working class anthem that long ago transcended any notion of class, which is very much the case. It often tops the polls as the most significant pop song in contemporary Australian music history. It's interesting, the story behind that, which has been told before, but Harry talks about it being a bugger to write, very, very difficult, and that their manager wanted to get a verse into the song as well.
Oh, I love that. For a chick doll, you're a drag. That was the manager's opening line for a verse in Friday on My Mind, and apparently George had to really put his foot down and stop that nonsense.
Yes, wisely.
But again, they just went to see a movie, and there was a short film, preview film before the movie about Canadian swingles singers, and they just got the riff from that, and they went home going, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, that's interesting, we could do something with that. You know, they didn't know that Friday on My Mind was going to become the iconic, legendary song that it has. They're both very fond of it, but they don't, you know, they don't dwell on that any more than some of the more psychedelic stuff they did later for the Easy Beats. Just very, very no-nonsense guys.
I'm talking to Debbie Kruger this afternoon on 936 ABC Hobart. Her book, Songwriters Speak, speaks to some of the finest songwriting talent this country has produced in recent times. Debbie, Johnny Young's an interesting character because he's always had this clean-cut image, and yet he's responsible for some very significant pop songs like Smiley and, in particular, The Real Thing for Russell Morris. Can you repeat the scenario that Johnny described to you about Molly Meldrum pounding on his door at 3 a.m, demanding that he hand the song over to her?
Oh, well, that was quite funny because Johnny, you know, wasn't always such a clean-cut guy. He was, you know, a hippie in the late 60s, and he told the story about how he was just sitting around with his band and they were jamming a little bit and all playing guitars, and he came up with this idea, and it was quite a long, rambling thing of a song, The Real Thing, and it was very acoustic and gentle and just, you know, happy, all that kind of thing. And Meldrum was wandering around and said, what's that, what's that? And Johnny said, no, this is just something that I'm putting together for me and the band. You don't want to know about this. And Molly said, no, I want that for Russell Morris. You have to give me that song. And, yes, he did then turn up at Johnny's place at 3 a.m. and pounded on the door and said, you have to give me this song now. And so Johnny sort of got up bleary-eyed and sang the song into a tape recorder for Ian Meldrum, who went off and produced what I believe to be the seminal Australian pop song. Brought so many leading lights of the Melbourne music industry together, from Brian Cadd and his band The Group, who played on it, to John Farrar, who played and arranged on it, to Russell Morris, obviously, who sang it, and Russell's a songwriter in his own right and is also interviewed in the book. And Johnny's point with the song was just that everyone was going around going, oh, man, you know, it's the real thing, and Coke is the real thing. And Johnny's point was, well, actually, human beings are the real thing, you know, cut out all this BS. And that was the point of his song. So he talks about it in great detail, but so does Brian Cadd and so does Russell Morris. So it is one of those songs that that crosses over into several of the interviews in my book, and I love the story of The Real Thing.
I'm talking to Debbie Kruger, the author of Songwriters Speak, this afternoon on 936 ABC Hobart for Desert Island Discs. Debbie, you talked about Brian Cadd and his involvement with the group on The Real Thing. He's very much a fish out of water here. He eventually became a member of the Gumleaf Mafia in LA. Who were they?
Gumleaf Mafia is a loose term used to describe the Australian musical people who settled in Los Angeles, some of whom have stayed on, like Rick Springfield and Olivia Newton-John and Steve Kipner and John Farrar, and others who spent quite a bit of time there but eventually came back, such as Brian Cadd, Billy Thorpe, Russell Morris, Renee Geyer. There's always a gum leaf mafia over in LA, but they were, in the 70s, they really were it. And a very, you know, influential bunch of people. Brian really, you know, made a name for himself, not just in the group, but then in Axiom, where he wrote Little Ray of Sunshine and Arkansas Grass, both a couple of quite misunderstood songs, because Arkansas Grass was long considered to be Australia's first drug song, whereas in fact it was an anti-war song based on the story of the Civil War in America. And Little Ray of Sunshine, people have always thought he must have written it about his own child, but he actually wrote it about some friends who were breaking up their relationship but had just had a child, and the little baby was almost forgotten in this great acrimonious breakup that was happening. So he just wanted to point out, hello, there's a little ray of sunshine over here that you've created. Brian then went on and had a really successful solo career. He was at the forefront of the singer-songwriter movement that happened very briefly in the early 70s in Australia, that Russell Morris was also a part of, and also founded the Bootleg label and put together his own house band, the Bootleg Family Band. So a really influential character in the scene back at that time. And then, yeah, went over to America and wrote songs in LA and in Nashville and eventually came home.
Another one of his songs, you talked about Arkansas Grass, but Show Me the Way was misunderstood as well. It was effectively an anti-religious song.
I had to prise that one out of Brian. He started telling me the story and then went, oh, no, I don't want to tell this story because I'll shatter everyone's illusions, because, you know, religious people or people who have a firm faith in God, Jesus, whatever, could go to his shows and come up and go, oh, show me the way. It's all about what I believe in and it's so Christian. And it breaks his heart to sort of have to say to them, well, actually, I wrote it because I kind of was a bit annoyed with all the religious hokey pokey that was going on, you know, around. He wrote it while he was living in London, and everybody seemed to be into some kind of religion or meditation or something, and he just thought it was all rubbish. And so Show Me the Way was actually a satire. But he was very reluctant, and in fact he said to me after the interview sometime later, oh, I really don't want that in the book. And I said, too late. It's a good story.
You've signed a release. It's mine.
But he and many of the songwriters were a little concerned about shattering somebody's illusions, because they all believe that once a song is written and recorded and out there, they do lose control of it. It becomes whatever the listener wants it to be.
Very scratchy Brian Cadd, direct from the vinyl for Desert Island This Afternoon on 936 ABC Hobart. It's 3:30. Here's Peter G.
Two schools have been closed. ABC News.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, it'd be very hard for me to pass up on the old Peking duck. 29 minutes to four. You're listening to Desert Island Discs with Trevor Jackson this afternoon. My guest is Debbie Kruger, who's had the good fortune to be able to interview some of Australia's most prominent songwriters of the modern era. Her book is called Songwriters Speak, Conversations About Creating Music. Debbie, talking about perceptions of songs and, I guess, incorrect perceptions of songs with Brian Cadd there. But what about the rewards of songwriting in terms of the response that songwriters get back from fans regarding the perception of what they think a particular song is about?
Neil Finn describes how the most rewarding thing about being a songwriter is to have somebody come up to you and say, look, you know, this is what I believe about your song, and it, you know, it changed my life, or it got me through this hard time. He said there's nothing better than to hear that kind of feedback.
Speaking of the Finn brothers, Tim Finn, I was interested to read that I Hope I Never, which is such a beautifully haunting song, was written about ex-Split Enz member Phil Judd. Who knew?
I was surprised. Well, Split Enz fans apparently know, because they're quite fanatical, the friends of the ends. but I didn't know that story, which is that, in fact, yes, you listen to it and you think it must be about a love relationship between a man and a woman. But in fact, he had such a close relationship with Phil Judd, with whom he formed Split Enz, that when Phil left and after, in the years afterwards, wanted absolutely nothing to do with Tim and wouldn't communicate with him, Tim's heart was absolutely broken. So that's what he wrote it about. And it's such a beautiful, painful yearning piece of a song.
You ask a great question about tapping into the pain of a song like that 25 years after it was written. What did Tim say about it?
Can you tell me? Because I don't have a book in front of me.
I know you can't remember everything that was said. Well, he said the song takes on a personality of its own, if you like, and it's just a matter of performing it. You immediately tap into what was there 25 years ago.
I think it's always with you. I think what he said was that he doesn't necessarily have to go back to the actual pain that he felt at the time, but he can tap into it and almost like a performer, feel it again in a more present sort of way. Casey Chambers also talked to me about that, about how she doesn't necessarily have to relive the feelings of insecurity that created a song like The Captain. But when she's up there, she certainly taps into something that reconnects her to the emotion of the song and doesn't have to, as I say, relive the pain or the insecurity, but certainly can express those emotions in a performance of it today.
An extraordinary talent Tim Finn is. With Split Ends, I Hope I Never, and who knew that it was about, we all knew it was a relationship breakup, but I think most people assumed it was a man and a woman. But two blokes? Who would have thought? A songwriting partnership dissolving into that. Even more extraordinary because of it, I think. 21 minutes to four, you're listening to Desert Island Discs this afternoon with Trevor Jackson on 936 ABC Hobart. My guest is Debbie Kruger, a music journalist who's had the great fortune to be able to speak to some of our more prominent songwriters of the modern era. Don Walker's an interesting character. He's considered one of our finest songwriters produced at least in the last 30 years, if not ever. And I was interested to read that he wasn't the man that you imagined him to be.
Yeah, I mean, I tried not to go into these interviews with any preconceived ideas, but I didn't know Don before I interviewed him, and I did think that he was probably a slightly cynical, dark sort of character, brooding perhaps. But he's just incredibly sincere and warm and he was very generous. I spent several hours with Don talking about not only his Cold Chisel songs, but songs that he has written for his outside projects and his solo projects since then.
What was really interesting, and I think will intrigue and perhaps possibly even upset a few Chisel fans, is that Don Walker is a Sherbet fan and admitted that he was a David Gates fan as well.
Well, I don't know whether he's a Sherbet fan, and he certainly said that back in Cold Chisel heyday, they never aspired to have the kind of success that Sherbet did. They didn't want to be, you know, superstars and kings of pop and that sort of thing. They thought that was all, you know, a load of rubbish. But he has a great appreciation for fine pop craftsmanship. He loves... His favourite Vander and Young song is Lovers in the Air rather than Friday on My Mind. And he did say that he thought Child's Play by Garth Porter and Clive Shakespeare from Sherbet was a great pop song. And that, yes, he had admired David Gates' work as well. And if you listen to some of Don's songs for Cold Chisel, there is a great pop tunesmith quality about them. It's just that once, you know, you're at the tonsils of Jimmy Barnes or Ian Moss around them and all those great guitars and Steve Prestwich's great drumming, you have a rock song.
Of course.
Don is a great melodist, and that I think partly comes from him being a piano player as opposed to a guitar player. Although he did say that he actually writes songs away from any instrument. He writes lyrics and the melody comes to him as he's writing the lyrics. The lyrics sing the melody to him, and he only finally goes to the piano when he's got everything put together on paper.
Now, that's an insight. He also said that K-San isn't an albatross to him, despite its status as our alternative national anthem, if you like. He still enjoys playing it?
He does. He says he only generally plays it when he's with Cold Chisel again. He doesn't do it in his solo performances. I love the way how he described how K-San is actually a song that really annoys other Australian musicians, particularly when they're touring overseas, because whatever band or artist it is, some Australian yobbo in the audience goes, "Oh, do K-San," and it really, you know, it really annoys those musicians, and Don gets a kick from the fact that it annoys everyone else. But he did describe how it's actually a very unconventionally structured song, because it has no chorus, and the punchline of the song has nothing to do with what the song is about, which is the last plane out of Sydney. So he did say how today no publisher or record company would actually let you record a song like that.
The Mighty Chisel and K-San on 936 ABC Hobart. You're listening to Desert Island Discs 13 to 4. Trevor Jackson with Debbie Kruger this afternoon, the author of Songwriter Speak. Debbie, when you look over the responses you've had from our prominent songwriters, Paul Kelly, Deborah Conway, Tim and Neil Finn, Richard Clapton, Glenn Shorrock, John Williamson, Ross Wilson, Harry Vander, George Young, is there one element, one commonality that separates them from the rest of the pack, do you think?
It was that unself-consciousness about the writing in the early years for so many of these songwriters that I spoke to that created such incredible, memorable hits. I think today so many songwriters are so consciously trying to write what contemporary hit radio wants to play, what Australian Idol might, what someone on Australian Idol might perform, that there is in some ways a loss of that magic. There are still, very sincere songwriters out there today, particularly people like Pete Murray, Missy Higgins, who I think are, whose work perhaps in 10, 20 years will have endured in the same way that the songwriters in my book, that their work has endured. But there is definitely a culture around today that is at odds with the kinds of ways that the songwriters I spoke to were working.
Debbie, you spoke to Jim Magini and Rob Hurst of Midnight Oil, the principal songwriters for the band. It's interesting to hear their thoughts on the strong political messages of their songs. Jim once said, "It's just a bloody band, back off on the politics," and was reprimanded by other band members and management for saying it.
Yes, so I was really quite surprised and touched by the candor that Jim Magini and Rob Hurst spoke to me with, that while they have this great affection for Peter Garrett and respect for him and a great love for the band that they played with for 25 years, that there were these tensions, that they wanted to write songs that moved beyond the boundaries of what was political, what was environmentally pertinent. They would have liked, Jim Magini would have liked to write psychedelic love songs. And Rob talked about this tangential quality that he felt the Oils music should have had. And both those songwriters have explored those sorts of things in their own projects outside of Midnight Oil. But certainly Rob described in detail how they would have a song pretty much ready to go. The red light would go on in the studio and Pete Garrett would whip out his own set of lyrics and start singing them, and Rob would stand there with tears in his eyes going, "But my song." Having said that, they always acknowledged when Pete Garrett's lyrics were right on the mark and that his contributions to certain songs that were pretty much complete, such as Beds Are Burning, and Peter would come along and go, "No, you need something in there along the lines of, the time has come, let's give it back."
What I would like to ask you about Diesel and Dust is, it's interesting that for them that album was their creative peak sonically, but also their most commercial success, and they talk a lot about the ability to create the sounds of the outback and the desert on that record, which they achieved in a phenomenal way, really.
Well, and it's interesting because Rob said all they wanted to do really after recording in Japan and spending a fortune on an album, which was Red Sails in the Sunset and using all sorts of high-tech gizmos in this brand new studio in Tokyo, but they just wanted to go and write and record, write some songs around a campfire and three chord kind of structured songs and keep it very simple. And interestingly, that's what those simple structures were what appealed. I don't think the songs are as simple as they say. I think there's a lot of craftsmanship in there, and Rob certainly says he works very, very hard on the lyrics to get them so succinct. There's a lot of trimming and a lot of sweat that goes into it, and he does describe that in the interview.
Debbie, one of your great regrets in putting the book together was that you missed out on speaking to some great songwriters who we've lost, like Slim Dusty, and Michael Hutchence was another.
Well, I spoke to Andrew Farris, yes, and I spoke to Joy McKean, Slim's wife. So in those respects, I was very lucky to still get the stories of those songwriters. There were other songwriters I missed who, you know, like Peter Allen, I'll just never know what it was like to be Peter Allen writing I Honestly Love You. And that's certainly a regret. But the Farris, Andrew Farris had some great stories.
Like the fact that they were big Rolf Harris fans and that Tim wanted to call his son Rolf Harris.
Well, Rolf told me. That was just charming because I'd interviewed Andrew a couple of years before I got to interview Rolf. And when I went to see Rolf, I said, you know, Andrew Farris told me you were one of his greatest early inspirations. And he said, well, yes. And as it happens, I met Tim Farris, his brother, once. He came up to me on a plane and he introduced himself and he told me that he'd wanted to call his son Rolf, as in Rolf Farris. But fortunately, his wife wouldn't let him. And Rolf said, oh, thank God, poor bugger. It would have been quite a blight in his life to be called Rolf Farris. Rolf is very self-effacing and down-to-earth and charming.
The other insight, which is interesting, was that Ray Manzarek from The Doors went to an NXS concert to meet Michael Hutchence because he was so disturbed by how much Hutchence reminded him of Jim Morrison.
And, yes, I mean, we all think that. We all think right down to the strange, bizarre way that Michael died, that there was a strong connection with the Jim Morrison thing. But, yes, for Ray Manzarek, a legend, to sort of be at home watching MTV and seeing NXS on the television and being so disturbed that he, you know, having found out that NXS were actually in town playing a gig, he went straight over there and said, look, I had to come here and meet you because of this uncanny resemblance you have to Jim. Yeah, quite a story.
What a fabulous opportunity to speak to some fine talents, some of the finest talents we've produced in the songwriting department. The book is called Songwriters Speak, Conversations About Creating Music. Debbie Krieger, it's been a pleasure to have you as my guest on Desert Island Discs. Thanks for taking the time.
Trevor, thank you for having me.